when money becomes a woman's first love.
She was under the mistaken impression that her father was wealthy and hiding money from her.
You'll regret this.
Friends and family can be victims.
I'm just going to the bathroom, okay?
Very ugly, very brutal. Blood everywhere.
Of their greed.
I want to get back at you.
That one of their own should be the killer was something which psychologically traumatized that community.
And remorse is non-existent.
She didn't seem to shed any tears.
For these deadly women, life is worth nothing. They kill for cash. A woman wanting revenge.
She was very bitter against her father.
Can be dangerous.
That somebody else had to die, that didn't bother her.
And the consequences, unimaginable.
No one questioned how ridiculous this plan was.
In every town, there are people living on the edge. In 2003, Erie, Pennsylvania, Marjorie Deal Armstrong is one of them. Unable to hold down a job, she's desperate for cash.
I have nothing. Nothing.
Well, if you got nothing, what are you complaining about?
At 51, Marjorie appeals to her father to bail her out yet again. It's a far cry from her early days.
She was a valedictorian of her high school class, was considered to be an intelligent person.
Classmates described her as extremely intelligent, that she had an almost encyclopedic grasp of history, literature, and the law.
You don't care a damn about me, Dad.
But in middle age, Marjorie has nothing, so when her mother dies and leaves an inheritance of $500,000, Marjorie thinks it should be hers.
Her father gave her $50,000 and essentially told her he was planning on spending the rest.
No, sir. I can't afford to give you more.
This did not make her happy.
Marjorie believes her father is stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from her.
You'll regret this.
Her anger is compounded by mental illness.
The bipolar disorder that she suffered from seemingly caused lots of problems in how she behaved and dealt with things. And again, it's one of the sad side effects of mental illness.
Bipolar disorder is a very serious psychiatric condition characterized by wide mood swings from being extremely depressed to what is known as a mania, a kind of wonderful euphoric high.
Marjorie wants revenge against her father and her hands on her inheritance at any cost.
Her plan was to hire a hitman to assassinate her father, and then she would be rich.
So, will you do it, Ken?
Yeah, I'll do it.
She asks fishing buddy Ken Barnes to do her dirty work.
But I'm gonna need 125 grand up front.
But murder comes at a price.
Okay, but I can't pay you until I get the inheritance.
No way. It's money up front or it's no deal.
How can an impoverished woman come up with that much cash? By coming up with another madcap scheme.
She simply was not using common sense. Decided, we'll get $125,000. We'll just rob a bank.
Marjorie recruits another accomplice, her former lover and science teacher, Bill Rothstein.
The box fits on the collar. The collar goes on the neck, obviously.
He was really intelligent in terms of how to build complicated and complex devices. That was something that he did for students in class.
If we use a Carla bomb, then they'll have to let him leave the bank.
Their heist calls for a human bomb.
They wouldn't dare shoot him or try and touch him.
They'll have to know that we can blow it up if they approach him.
Do you think he'll do it, Ken?
And Marjorie knows just the right patsy to wear it.
Speaking of the devil.
Oh, Brian!
Hey, guys.
You're gonna help us rob a bank.
Hey. What?
But first, I need to measure your neck.
Yeah, joking, right?
Brian Wells basically lived by himself. He had cats in a small, very unassuming house, and he had worked as this pizza delivery man.
What are you talking about?
Brian is told the bomb will be a fake, but trusting Marjorie is dangerous.
Marjorie's bipolar mania was absolutely out of control. It was controlling her life. No one was safe.
Marjorie Deal Armstrong is holding a deluded grudge against her father. She's prepared to go to extremes to get revenge.
This motley crew of characters decided to hatch this plot to rob a local bank and get that money and then use it to pay for the hit on Marjorie Deal's father.
It's a great plan. We'll all be rich, James.
Marjorie shares her secret with her boyfriend, James Roden.
You must be crazy. Please tell me you're joking. You can't go through with this.
But she gets a negative response.
Don't do it, or I'll...
You'll what, James? You won't tell anyone, will you?
And that's bad news for James.
Of course not.
Will you?
No!
Marjorie was the type of woman people didn't say no to.
She convinces Bill Rothstein, her collaborator, to help cover up the murder.
Rothstein not only disposed the body in his freezer, but I understand he also had cleaned up the room where the murder had taken place.
Marjorie gives him another gruesome task.
You promise you'll grind him up later, though, won't you? Sure.
With a lot of these people involved with this conspiracy, were easily manipulated to do things that possibly they wouldn't actually want to do. And that was one of the things with Brian Wells.
Marjorie's crazy plan calls for a bank robbery to raise the money to pay for the hitman to kill her father.
Next, please.
The PNC Bank will be held up by a man, not with a gun, but wearing a fake collar bomb. But on the day of the robbery, Brian Wells finds out the bomb is real.
These explosives look real.
They are. It's just to make sure you and everyone in the bank behaves.
Frank. Hey, keep still, Brian. Much movement and that bomb will go off.
Marjorie's manipulation knows no limits. Everyone in her gang is under her control. Brian's life is in her hands.
We believe he was part of the conspiracy up until the time he realized that they're going to put a live bomb on him.
Next, please.
The plan is simple. Brian hands over a note threatening to blow up everyone unless they empty the vault.
There's no way that I can get to the vault right now, sir.
It's a bomb.
But from the start, things don't go according to plan. The teller can't open the vault, and Brian only gets money from the till.
This is all I can get you, sir.
It was not a good plan. She gave him $8,100, which is all she had. Brian Wells said, okay, and walked out of the bank.
Brian's day is about to go from bad to worse.
As this bank was being robbed by Brian Wells, law enforcement was across the street, eating.
Be careful. This thing is going to go off. This thing around my neck is going to go off. You hear a ticking?
We heard on the scanner this report of state police had stopped somebody who had just robbed a bank, and he had a bomb. And that's when we kind of realize, I don't think this is a fake bomb. Something big is going on. This is something that's beyond the ordinary.
Police soon realize the bomb is a threat to everyone. They isolate Brian and call the bomb squad.
Why is it nobody's trying to get this thing off me? I don't have a lot of time.
The state police, there's really not much they could have done. They weren't bomb technicians. They didn't have bomb suits. They don't know what device this is, how it's going to go off, whether it's triggered by a remote. So really, there's not a lot they could do. Just sit and wait for the bomb squad to arrive.
Witnessing the whole debacle are Marjorie and her accomplice, Bill. They have no control. And neither does anyone else.
Come and help me!
The bomb squad will be too late.
Do you hear me? It's ticking!
When all of a sudden, bang.
I'm not lying!
You could hear the tinkling of shrapnel hitting the ground a few feet from where we were standing. The FBI said that they have never seen anything like before or since.
Brian Wells decided to help with the bank robbery. He knew exactly what he was getting into. He did not, however, intend to die.
Brian Wells and her boyfriend, James, are dead. And still, Marjorie hasn't got enough money to hire her hitman.
Marjorie didn't mind having collateral damage that if in her plot to get money to kill her father, that if somebody else had to die, that didn't bother her.
Nobody suspects Marjorie of any crime until Bill Rothstein snaps.
I can't do it.
He has promised to grind up Marjorie's boyfriend, but he would rather give himself up.
Police, I need to talk to somebody. Yeah, I need to report a body. Yes.
January 2005. Marjorie is initially convicted of her boyfriend's murder. It takes another 5 years to prove her involvement in the Collar Bomb Bank robbery. She is sentenced to life.
Had Marjorie sought out psychiatric treatment, it's entirely possible she never would have killed anyone and might have actually had a happy life.
Bill Rothstein dies from cancer before he is sentenced. Ken Barnes pleads guilty and is sentenced to 45 years.
It's amazing what people will do to get what they want.
To this day, Marjorie claims her bipolar condition makes her not responsible.
The vast majority of people with bipolar disorder, whether treated or not, never, ever would kill another person and never do kill anyone. That isn't what happened here.
When life goes off the rails.
She doesn't care about somebody else. She doesn't care about a child.
And it is difficult to survive.
She needed those drugs and there was nothing that was gonna stop her.
Desperation can lead to desperate action.
This is not someone we want out walking among us.
In 1988, on the dark streets of Anaheim, California, a teenage girl is desperate for cash to feed a habit.
Rosie used heroin. She used whatever she could get her hands on.
Rosie Alfaro's traumatic life has left her scarred.
She began using drugs at an early age. She was turned out as a prostitute at the age of 14, constantly running away from home.
Rosie's family feels powerless to help.
Her mother indicated that she would see her loaded, see her with the drug use when she would come to visit her, but there was nothing she could do.
By 18, Rosie has a son, but nowhere to live. The family of a school friend, 18-year-old April Wallace, takes them in. She has a 9-year-old sister, Autumn, who loves having an extended family, but the rest of the household doesn't.
She was using drugs.
No, I thought the opposite.
And the people that she hung around were drug users.
Rosie, have you fed Daddy?
No, I'm in a time. Can't you do it?
That's just not good enough. I said that you could stay with us if you helped around the place that you want. And where are you going? You should be at home resting.
No, I've just got to meet some friends.
Despite the generosity of the family, Rosie doesn't settle down.
She passed her time during the day trying to find things that would bring her money so she could buy drugs.
She can't stay here if she goes on like that.
She's told to leave, but it won't be the last time Rosie visits the Wallaces. Rosie has a new home, a squalid one, and she's desperate for money.
She's living near Disneyland, and it was in a kind of a rundown area with a bunch of junkies.
Drugs and alcohol in the human body reduce inhibitions. And sometimes when people are high on either one of those things or both, they will do things that they never would have even considered in their clean and sober moments.
Well, did you get any?
No, he said no more credit.
I can't. I'm coming down now.
No money, no way.
One day on June 15th, 1990, cold-hearted Rosie will do anything to get high.
Wait. I know we can get some stuff to sell.
In the past, she sold her body. Today, she has another idea. The Wallace family has a routine.
Autumn often stayed by herself in the afternoon after school before her mom got home in the evening.
So it's a nice surprise for the 9-year-old when she gets a visit from a familiar face.
When she saw Rosie at the door, there's no question she would have let her in and just trusted her.
Home alone, Autumn enjoys the company. Little does she know, she's playing with danger.
She needed those drugs, and there was nothing that was going to stop her.
I'm just going to the bathroom, okay?
Okay.
Teenage mom, Rosie Alfaro, is a drug addict desperate for money. In the past, she has sold herself. Now she has another plan. On June 15th, 1990, 9-year-old Autumn Wallace is home alone.
Autumn was a little 9-year-old, a little blonde girl, very cute, and very popular at school. And she gave her mom no trouble whatsoever, a very easy child, very smart child.
I'll be back soon.
Rosie arrives with her baby and two druggies.
Give me a break.
Hi, Autumn, can I come in?
But Rosie's idea of robbery is stealing a life.
To keep a witness from saying who it was that stole all the stuff out of the house. She realized she's gonna have to kill her because she'd recognize her. Rosie indicated she saw a knife in the kitchen, and she took that knife.
I'm just going to the bathroom, okay?
Okay.
And then went back in the bathroom under the guise of fixing her hair.
Can you come in here for a moment?
Sure.
And lured Autumn into the bathroom.
These for me.
Okay.
The stab wounds were in her back and in her front and in her face. They were all over. She was laying on her back. It was very ugly, very brutal. Blood everywhere. She stabbed her repeatedly, over 50 times.
The fact that Rosie stabbed Autumn in excess of 50 times, a 9-year-old girl, one well-placed stab wound would have done the job, but she does it 50 times or more, to me, speaks of rage and drugs. Maybe because of that, Rosie didn't want any other little girl to have a happy life either. And maybe there was more revenge in this killing than we think.
Rosie definitely remembers seeing Autumn's eyes looking at her when she finally died. It's very disturbing, very disturbing.
Hey guys, open the trunk.
Rosie ransacks the house.
After Rosie stabbed Autumn, she stepped over her, and with a bloody footprint, she went from room to room looking for items to steal. Leaving that little boy, that toddler, in the front of that house while she's in there brutally killing an 8-year-old girl, it's just unimaginable for a mother to be able to do that.
2 hours later, a hard-working mom's life turns upside down.
Give you 200.
Can't you give me a bit more?
Rosie wastes no time fencing the stolen goods for a pitiful amount.
I'll give you 240. Take it or leave it.
Take it.
Afterwards, I think the net figure she got was $240. Kind of a cheap price for the life of a little 9-year-old girl.
Cash in hand, Rosie returns to the scene of her crime.
I'm a friend of April's. Can I speak to her?
No, ma'am, that's not possible.
Often killers return to the scene of the crime.
She would have passed it on.
There's a variety of different reasons they do this. Sometimes it's to view the body. Sometimes it's to remove evidence they may have left. Sometimes it's for kicks. It turns them on. Rosie returning to the scene of the crime put her right into the center of the investigation.
And she's made another mistake. she leaves a bloody footprint.
There's only one footprint in blood near the body. So there was a lack of any other footprints.
The police officer remembers the suspicious teenager on the night of the murder. They track Rosie down.
And that bloody shoe print, they had something concrete to go on. They found the shoes in where she was living and matched a shoe print too. So Rosie did herself in as far as getting caught for that crime.
In 1992, Rosie Alfaro is convicted of first-degree murder and is condemned to die.
She had no feelings for what she had done to another human being, especially a young child, and especially being a mother herself. It's very disturbing, very disturbing.
Rosie chooses drugs over a child's life and has never said sorry.
Rosie is a sociopath, and she has no empathy for other human beings. And it would help explain why she was able to, number one, murder her friend's little sister in such a horrible way, and number two, have no remorse about it.
She remains on death row in the Central California Women's Facility.
This is not someone we want out walking among us.
Envy of others can be dangerous.
That would be her dream, to own such a property.
It can turn neighbor against neighbor.
She would say anything to get what she wanted.
I don't even know if I can tell you.
With chilling consequences.
What happened, Kim?
This involved a degree of violence that was very great.
That leave communities in shock.
That one of their own should be the killer, which psychologically traumatized that community.
Nowra, New South Wales, Australia. A small, peaceful town where Greg Hosa and his wife, Catherine McKay, own a horse farm.
They were just a loving couple, gave their time for community groups and organizations.
They board horses on their property. One of their clients is 35-year-old Kim Snibson, a mom with two young daughters.
Kim Snibson seemed to be your average mom. She was an animal lover. She had dogs, she had a horse. She seemed to like the rural lifestyle of Nowra.
But Kim is a very jealous person. She envies Greg and Catherine's small property. She can only dream of owning one, for now.
Champagne Shires would be her dream, to own such a property. It reflected all the things that she loved the most, touching upon her connection with animals.
Kim has a dark side she hides from her family and an evil plan.
For a significant period of time, she had plans which involve the infliction of violence to obtain something, probably property.
We could do this. We'll kidnap them, get them to sign the house over to me, and then kill them.
She tries to recruit acquaintances to help.
What do you think?
Most think she is joking.
Yeah, sure, Kim. No worries.
She's not.
No, I'm serious. We could do this, and we could split the money 50-50.
There was a history of manipulative behavior, lying in order to achieve her ends. There was the element of seeking people to sign over property to her.
Friends try to warn Kim's devoted husband, Paul.
Then she said, if I could help her to kill them.
About her bizarre plots.
Give us a break. Are you mad? My wife would never say that.
But he doesn't believe their stories.
Paul, she did say that.
Bye, honey.
Kim is a very bright person.
She did.
Unfortunately, she used that intellect of hers for evil.
Kim has the perfect place to stable her horse in the caring hands of Greg and Catherine.
She went to the property regularly to tend to her own horse and got to know Greg and Catherine in that way. They were very well respected and loved in that town. It's a small town. Everybody knows each other.
Kim always wants something for nothing and doesn't pay the bill.
She owed them $300 for taking care of her horses.
It's a small amount.
Listen, I just wanted to let you know, I can't afford to pay my bill right now. But I promise I will pay as soon as I can.
It's okay, whenever you got it. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks.
No. Greg and Catherine are understanding, but that doesn't make Kim happy. Instead, it fuels her jealousy of the couple.
She envied what they had.
Clearly, she had her sights on them.
Kim starts fantasizing about owning their horse property.
She wanted them to somehow sign over their farm to her.
It's an insane idea. But like she's done in the past, she tries to recruit help.
I know that you're a family man, and I wasn't even sure if I should be telling you this, but...
By doing what she does best, manipulating people.
There was a history of manipulative behavior, lying in order to achieve her ends.
She spins neighbor Andrew Flintjar a wicked lie about Greg and Catherine.
Andrew was told by Kim that the couple had sexually abused her child and had videoed the episode.
That's disgusting. People like that should be shot.
Exactly. They need to be punished.
Yeah. I should belt him for touching her. The pervert.
There was no evidence at any time in court that Catherine or Greg had engaged in anything like that.
Andrew thinks it's just muscle she wants.
Out for it.
With Andrew on board, Kim approaches another neighbor.
Stacy Lee Caton was a known criminal. He had said that he had wanted to get his life back on track.
What? What happened, Kim?
Kim fabricates a different story.
He drugged me. And then he filmed me performing this lewd sex act. It was horrible.
Stacy Lee Caton was told by her that a couple had drugged her, sexually assaulted her, and videoed the episode.
It seems to be a total fantasy on her part.
Stacy.
So she employed a means of modulating the story, depending on the person who was the recipient of it, to press the right buttons. The theme was always one of sexual impropriety. And, of course, this nothing excites people's sympathy more than that.
Two men.
Stacy.
Two different lies. But both take the bait.
I want to get back at him.
She knew exactly what to say to each one to get them worked up enough to help her kill.
It was a very dangerous thing for her to do, because these two had never met each other before and had no reason to meet.
I'll help you, Kim. Just tell me what you want me to do.
Both men underestimate Kim's true nature.
100% there.
Ken Snibson was the perfect sociopath.
We'll make him pay.
Sociopaths love to manipulate other people. It's fun for them. They consider it part of the chase, part of the leading up to any crime.
Kim's ready to make her twisted dreams a deadly reality.
Finally, she worked up to the ultimate crime.
I've got an idea. It's going to take a lot of work.
January 28th, 2006. Nowra, Australia. 35-year-old Kim Snibson wants something for nothing. Her web of lies has convinced locals Andrew Flintjar and Stacy Lee Caton to help her. They think they are needed to rough up the owners of a horse farm.
Hi, Greg, can you come over? There's something I want to talk to you about.
Kim lures Greg Hossa to her house.
Okay.
Is he coming?
He's coming.
He came quickly after that conversation occurred. He didn't think that he was in any danger or that there would be any problem.
Kim, hello, it's me. It's Greg.
He was struck to the head with a lump of wood, hogtied, meaning his feet were bound and pulled up behind his back.
He said, why is this happening? Andrew Flintjar has said it's because of what you did to the kids, or he said something about being a pedophile.
The men finally realize they have been told different lies.
Which is not what Stacey Lee Caton had heard at all. That, according to him, that's not why he was there.
Kim must have known that the point in time would be reached where her lies would be exposed. But she would have then taken things to the point of no return.
With Greg in agony, Kim calls his wife, Catherine.
It's Kim.
It's a call any wife would dread.
There's something I need to tell you about Greg and I. We've been having an affair. Yeah, now's good. See you in a minute.
There had never been any affair between Greg and Kim Snibson.
Kim, what are you going on about? What's that phone call about? Greg would never do such a thing to me.
She too was hogtied. She too had a sock stuffed in the mouth and tape wrapped around her mouth as well. One can imagine the fear suffered by these people. This involved a degree of violence that was very great.
Kim gives Andrew and Stacey Lee chilling instructions. It's more than they bargained for.
Keep an eye out. We're gonna go get the
bathroom. They collected 44-gallon drums from Champagne Shires and brought them back to the house.
In an ominous move, Catherine is shoved into the oil drum. Kim has a horrific way to deal with her neighbor's resistance.
She murdered Catherine by wrapping tape around her face and eyes and nose. And they stood there and watched her die over several minutes.
Stacey Lee Caton looks on. It was never meant to come to this.
She's dead.
Now it's his turn.
Kim's got a different plan for Greg.
Kim killed Greg Hossa by garroting him with electrical wire. Kim killed them both deliberately and methodically.
Kim is a natural-born killer. She wanted to commit murder.
Kidnapped and brutally forced into makeshift coffins, a loving husband and wife are dead.
Once it got dark, the barrels were loaded into the back of Kim Snibson's station wagon and taken out to the state forest.
Kim Snibson commits one final grisly act.
They were doused in petrol and set alight.
Incinerating the bodies was done for no other purpose than to destroy evidence that those two poor people had ever been to Kim's house that day. I have been involved in some shocking crimes involving dreadful brutality. This case stands out because in my career, I can only reasonably expect to come across one or two sociopaths, and that's what Kim Snibson is.
Within hours, unable to live with the horror he's been part of. Stacey Lee Caton reveals the murderous deed.
Stacey Lee Caton went next door to his sister's house and spoke to her and her husband and gave them some details of what happened, and they took him to the police station.
The community was devastated by it. Devastated. That one of their own should be the killer was something which psychologically traumatised that community.
As daylight breaks, police find the gruesome remains.
All that remained of Catherine was her right foot, and little remained of Greg.
Thanks to Stacey Lee's confession, Kim's quickly arrested. Her delusion of taking over the horse farm would never be realized.
Would Kim have regret? None. There will be no remorse from Kim Snipson. It's not in her nature.
I sat there in that courtroom for a couple of weeks and just, she didn't seem to be shedding any tears.
Andrew Flintjar was found guilty of kidnapping and sentenced to 7 years. Stacey Lee Caton was jailed for 16 and a half years for aiding and abetting murder. On September 5th, 2008, Kim Snipson is found guilty of murdering Greg Hosa and Catherine McKay. She is sentenced to 32 years.
I think Kim's the only person that really knows why she did what she did.
A small town in Australia will never be the same.
Made people wonder, well, it could happen to anybody. And I think it really shook people up.
A person who does this lacks the quality that makes us human beings.
It's unlikely Kim feels remorse for what she did. Sociopaths never do. If she ever does emerge from prison, watch out.
For these deadly women, money truly was the root of their evil. Marjorie Diehl Armstrong's bizarre plan to get rich left a gruesome trail of death. Drug addict Rosie Alfaro brutally stabbed to death an innocent 9-year-old girl for a few $100s. And Kim Snipson viciously murdered a loving couple to steal their property. These deadly women were ready and able to kill for cash.